Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A celebration in Tehran, caution in Washington, D.C.
The issues at stake here are bigger than politics. These are matters of war and peace. For this is not simply a deal between my administration and Iran. This is a deal between Iran, the United States of America, and the major powers in the world. If Congress kills this deal, not based on expert analysis and without offering any reasonable alternative, then it's the United States that will be blamed for the failure of diplomacy.
President Obama and Iranian citizens of Tehran reacting to the so-called comprehensive framework announced yesterday in Lausanne, Switzerland, to set and verify limits on Iran's nuclear program. The next step, heading toward a verifiable nuclear deal with specific numerical targets. The details of the agreement will be finalized by the end of June of this year, and we will speak of them in a moment. But there is a sense of relief and jubilation in Tehran today. Joining us now is Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief of our partner, The New York Times. Welcome, Thomas.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
What kind of a moment is this in Iran, and how are Iranians hearing the, if not details, the spirit of this apparent agreement?
Well, it has all been pretty straightforward because for the first time in Iran's revolutionary history, President Obama was seen live on Iranian state TV giving his two cents on the deal, just as we were able to see him in the United States yesterday. Many people were very surprised. There is slowly a sense emerging that this is an historic agreement, that this is a path to a new future. But of course, many people are also fearful that in the coming weeks and months, hardliners, Israel, the Saudis, Republicans might create obstacles to the deal and in the end prevent it from happening on its actual deadline on June 30th.
So there was no great Satan talk, death to America kinds of responses to the president's speech that was televised in Iran.
No, it wasn't. And that also shows how Iran has been changing over the past years. You will rarely find a normal, ordinary Iranian shouting a death to America or down with the great Satan. These are the images that you see at the Friday prayers. These are the images that you hear from also in our media. But for ordinary Iranians, these are slogans of the past. They look very positively towards the United States. Not that they are without any criticism, but they don't immerse themselves in the ideological slogans that some of the hardliners do. No, instead, people were happy. They were happy to see President Obama because what they have been looking for is a sort of a reconnection to the world. They want this nuclear file to be closed. They want the sanctions to be lifted. And they want to become a more normal country, if you will.
Do Iranians believe a normal country means having some kind of nuclear program?
I do think that they believe that having a nuclear program is part of their rights, as government officials often state. They look in the region, they look at Israel that has, according to them, over 150 nuclear weapons. And they say we are signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, whereas Israel is not. We don't want to make nuclear weapons. Why does the West not allow us to have a nuclear energy program? And today at the Friday prayers, you could see a government official who usually don't speak at such a session, they're usually reserved for hardliners. He was saying that a lot had been achieved. He said, look, the United States didn't want to allow us to have a single centrifuge. Now we will have our own nuclear energy program. They didn't allow us to have the full fuel cycle. Now we will have it. This has been a win-win situation, not only for us, but also for the world powers, was their message today.
Thomas Erdbrink is Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Thomas.
Thank you.
From the reactions to this deal in Tehran, Iran's capital, to Washington, D.C., the U.S. capital, how is it going to be received in Washington, D.C.? Let's talk with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, how is the media within the Beltway taking a look at this, and how is that going to be picked up by the lawmakers who may have a decision to make here?
Well, lawmakers do have a decision to make here because they are intent with going ahead, despite the deal announced yesterday, with plans to have Congress weigh in on this. Now, timing is what's going to be critical. John, some of the reaction, especially from Republicans, won't surprise you. Republicans who are running for president, and there are several of them in the Congress, reacting very negatively. Marco Rubio called it a diplomatic failure. Interestingly, no response from Rand Paul, Ted Cruz criticizing the deal as a failure as well. However, what really matters here, Senator Bob Corker, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Now, John, he has said he has a lot of questions about this deal still, but that he wants to give it a close review. And here's what's going to happen in the next week or two in the Senate. Corker says he is going ahead with a committee hearing and markup next week of his bill that says that this deal has to be submitted to Congress in 60 days, and that no sanctions can be lifted within that period. It also says that Congress gets a vote on this deal ultimately. Now, as you know, there are also lots of Republicans and Democrats who want new sanctions now, or they want to vote to slap new sanctions on as soon as June 30th if the final parts of this deal fall through. Senator Mark Kirk, who's from Illinois and one of the main sponsors of that bill, told reporters yesterday that they're going to wait. They're going to wait till at least June 30th for that part of the deal. That doesn't mean that congressional review doesn't go forward. Democrats, interestingly, John, Senator Bob Menendez, who's a very hawkish voice, a very skeptical voice, former senior Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. He's been marginalized, of course, because of his 14-count indictment from the Justice Department for corruption. The new ranking member, Senator Ben Cardin, he's from Maryland. He has also said that he wants congressional review, said yesterday that Congress has a role to play, but didn't mention any bills and said he's looking forward to reviewing the legislation, took a sort of a more diplomatic, if you will, approach to the deal here.
And the lawmakers will focus on the sanctions, and there are a lot of details circulating, and timing on the sanctions is not one of the details circulating here for obvious reasons, it would seem. A single nuclear Iranian facility for 15 years, that's what's circulating, a limit on centrifuges from 19,000 down to about 6,000. A 15-year stockpile will be permitted by the Iranians. The all-important breakout period goes from a 2 to 3 month period to produce a bomb to a year, and that lasts for a decade. Thinking about the hearings, Corker's hearings particularly, does the GOP believe that the Pentagon is not capable of keeping a watchful eye on Iran's nuclear program after the Cold War, Pakistani nukes, defending against North Korea, that sort of thing?
It's a key question. It's sort of the tacit underlying question from the president yesterday when he said he wants this deal to be reviewed on the merits. It's a matter of war and peace and not a matter of politics. So when they get to the merits, you mentioned a lot of them right there, John. It's probably not the Pentagon, though. We're talking about the IAEA, International Inspection Agencies, through the UN that would have to do a lot of these inspections and likely would. Americans are familiar with that agency from its role in Iraq before the Iraq War, and in other places as well. Some of the key questions coming from Congress, though, on unanswered questions in the deal, things that still need to be worked out between now and June 30th, and even things that appear differently to John Kerry than to the Iranians after the deal yesterday. One, what exactly happens to all of Iran's fissile material? Not clear in the announcement yesterday. Two, why does the Fordo reactor, which was previously secret, why does that even stay open? Why isn't it being closed and destroyed? Why leave it open and turn it into a research facility? And three, exactly how quickly do sanctions get lifted after June 30th? What does Iran actually have to show in terms of action and good faith to start to get the sanctions lifted? Those questions weren't answered yesterday. Those are key specific questions that Bob Corker has. And John, the final thing I'll tell you, the number that matters here is 67. Bob Corker has the votes to pass his bill. He probably has about 64 votes right now. Republicans and Democrats. If Obama vetoes that bill, which he's promised to do, they'll need 67 to override him. Corker isn't there yet, and Democrats have control over that part of the process, those last three votes that Corker would potentially need.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
And now a very different perspective, personal, but also the expert view of someone who has been in the Foreign Service for 33 years. Don Cook was also one of the Americans held hostage in Iran from 1979 to 1981. Don Cook, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
You're out of public life officially, but your comments certainly matter here. What's your impression to the reaction in Washington, the celebrations going on in some quarters in Iran, to all that we've heard?
Well, I guess I have a couple of reactions to what's going on. And I think the president is correct when he says that we really need to see what the final deal is before we decide how we're going to react. But I would say, even from the preliminary words that we have, there is some cause for concern. As you say, I've been doing this for 33 years, and I find that in a negotiation, when you wrap it up and three different sides tell you three different contradictory stories about what happened, that you've probably got a problem.
What do you make of the impressions of Thomas Erdbrink of the New York Times in Tehran, who says that you, if ever, rarely hear the comments death to America, or talks about the great Satan, that Iranians want to move on and Iranians aren't interested in a war with the U.S., particularly a nuclear war with the U.S., and that the rhetoric of the hostage era is an impediment to just moving into the 21st century?
Well, you have a couple of things there. One of them is I have a number of Iranian friends who are refugees, Iranian friends who are true opponents of the current regime. And when I talk to them, they'll tell you about how the regime is evil and how they're oppressing people's rights. But then you talk about the nuclear program and they become very defensive. And they say, well, you know, India has a bomb, Pakistan has a bomb. Why can't we Iranians have a nuclear weapon? And so you find, at least on the nuclear side of things, there are a lot of people in the moderate opposition who actually would want to continue with a nuclear weapons program. It's been at least a generation or two, 35 years of the Islamic Republic and the end of the hostage crisis. And everybody coming up through the schools in Iran has been fed a steady diet of anti-Americanism. And so while the people we talk to in the Western educated parts of the Iranian government seem very moderate, seem very reasonable, in fact, you really do have this very strong undercurrent of hatred of the United States, which has been fed to them from the time that they were children.
What do you make of your reactions to this deal, maybe being personally motivated by what was robbed from you in your time as a hostage?
Well, I have no real resentment against Iran, the Iranian people. And so, no, I mean, I could see a real rapprochement with Iran, but this is not the route. It hasn't started. This doesn't indicate a sea change in attitudes in Tehran.
He spent 33 years in the Foreign Service. Don Cook was one of the Americans held hostage in Iran from 1979 to 1981. Don Cook, thanks so much.
All right, you're welcome.
So we're at halftime here at The Takeaway. You want to stick around for the second half, of course. A reminder, we are on Twitter at The Takeaway. Please do follow us there. And you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry. I'll answer your tweets. What you're listening to is really only made possible by those who contribute to public radio. If you do, thank you. If you don't, please think about giving whatever you can to your local public radio station. They need it, and you'll feel good about being part of a community that values stories like this. It's Friday. It's Good Friday. And that means something to you, Sean Ramaswamy.
I like the good stuff.
Sean Ramaswamy, host of Sideshow, Studio 360 podcast about the kind of art you don't see in museums. He's here on Good Friday. Mm-hmm. with your Friday Five, the things that you don't have to troll for because Sean found them for you. Number one.
It's the story by this guy named Matt Stopera who lost an iPhone, like many people have before him.
However, oh, no.
Exactly what I said. However, he followed his iPhone. He found photos on his iPhone photo stream that weren't his, and he figured out they were in China, and he wrote a story about it for BuzzFeed. The story gets picked up in China. It blows up in China. The guy who ended up with his stolen phone, who, not who stole it, but who ended up with the phone, contacts him. He goes over there with this team from BuzzFeed. It turns out there's this huge media storm when he gets to the airport. They ended up following him around. He does a press conference. There's going to be a documentary by something called BuzzFeed Motion Pictures. It's a beautiful thing, John. Number two, something less positive. This guy's trolling people at bookstores. A comedian is putting fake self-help books at his local bookstore. They have titles like The Beginner's Guide to Human Sacrifice and So Your Son is a Centaur, Coping with Your Child's Confusing Life Choices. He completes the jackets. He even replaces like the book section titles. It's great. He goes all out. It's on the takeaway.org, folks.
But you can't actually read a book on human sacrifice.
I don't think he writes the whole book, unfortunately.
All right, number three.
You can only go so far for an internet joke.
Yeah, that's right.
Number three, speaking of how far you go for an internet joke, Funny or Die on April Fool's Day this week invented a new social media platform called Dips. It's a take on Vine. They got a whole slew of celebrities from John Hamm to Britney Spears to make 1.5-second looping videos. I think we have John Hamm's.
When I get up on my hip, when I get up on my hip, when I get up on my hip.
Yeah, he sounds like rehab has done wonders for him. Yes,
too soon.
Too soon. What? Mad Men is ending.
It's true. Okay. So Adam McKay, the co-founder of Funny or Die, calls this the next generation of social media. It's like Vine, but more pointless. But it was a pretty good joke.
Number four.
Well, number four, another sort of stab at our digital world is this web series called Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. It's kind of like Sesame Street for adults. There's a couple of different takes of Sesame Street for adults. There was Wonder Chosen on Adult Swim. But this one's really good. It's by this British pair of puppeteers named Becky Sloan and Joseph Pelling. And this week they uploaded their latest episode, and it's about a group of puppets trying to figure out what the biggest thing in the world is, and their puppet computer comes alive to convince them to enter the dark web to find out.
I'm a computery guy. Everything made out of buttons and wires. I'd like to show you inside my digital life. Inside my mind, there is a digital mind.
All right, Sean, love you. You're telling me this web series is great, and your example of that is this, like, weird robot.
Yes.
All right.
No, it's easy to be a clever, smart boy like me if you just do it all digitally.
Wow.
I just like the song. The song, it goes into a darker place, but that was sort of the exposition, you know? I can't hit you with the third act.
Number five.
Number five, there's a little bit of autotune in that song you didn't like. There's more autotune in this one. This is a Game of Thrones remix from season two.
I'm a free woman.
You're not a free woman. You're my prisoner.
You don't need to live your whole life taking commands from old men. Be free. I'm a free woman.
You're not a free woman. You're my prisoner.
You know nothing.
All right.
It was John Hamm.
Happy Easter.
Hey, same to you.
Have a great weekend.
Passover.
And Passover.
What else is happening this weekend?
Oh.
Happy first weekend of April. Spring, 60 degrees.
Looking up my Friday Five. That's what I'm doing. Sean Ramos Varam, host of Sideshow, Studio 360 podcast about the kind of art you don't see in museums and that doesn't get sacrificed on this tragic weekend of Christianity.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Tickets, please.
Friday Movies, and it's Kristen Meinzer here with us, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Also, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So we begin with the franchise that's maybe a bridge too far, Furious 7.
You remember Owen Shaw? The one we tore half of London down trying to get. Well, this is Big Bad Brother, British Special Forces assassin. Kind of unique asset that no government would ever admit to employing.
How do I find him?
You do whatever it is you gotta do.
What do you think?
I'm a big fan of the Fast and Furious movies. I just think they're a lot of fun. It's spectacle. It's stunts. I think it's great filmmaking when it all works well. You do see Paul Walker here. This is his final role. Occasionally, you might notice that his brothers, Cody and Caleb, were stand-ins on some of these smaller scenes. I think it's a lot of fun. You got to check your brain at the door, but I think it's a really enjoyable
check
film.
Check your what at the door?
That would be your brain.
Your brain at the door. Kristen, did you check your brain at the door?
No, I have to check my brain at the door every time I see one of these movies. But in this particular movie, they were just so much more creative with all the stunts. We're talking about flying out of airplanes, flying from one skyscraper through the glass windows of another, and then, that's not enough, into another skyscraper. And
this movie didn't have a budget. It had a GDP.
Yes.
I guess that's
yes.
It was unbelievable.
Saying.
It was pretty fun.
So the takeaway here is this movie, if you suspend your sort of cranium, is a great movie for probably everyone except for a driver's ed instructor.
That's correct. Right. That's correct. Don't do this at home.
All right. Movie number two, Woman in Gold.
My aunt. My uncle commissioned Gustav Klimt to paint her. She was taken off the walls of our home by the Nazis. And since then, she's been hanging in the Belvedere Gallery in Vienna.
And now you'd like to be reunited.
I have to do what I can to keep these memories alive.
Simon Curtis' movie, Woman in Gold, is about territory that George Clooney tried to embrace the Nazi theft in Monuments Man of art during World War II. What do you think, Kristen?
Well, this time around, it's a more personal story. We're actually dealing with a woman who really did exist named Maria Altman, played by Helen Mirren in this film. It's a moving journey, but it's also mostly pleasant. I wouldn't say that this is one of those movies that you're going to be knocked out by. You're not going to cry during necessarily, but I think you're going to enjoy it. And then that's about it.
Yeah, I think this is very heavily stamped with the Weinstein Company brand. It feels very much like The King's Speech, like Philomena. Philomena packed a punch. This one really, I feel like, fell flat. I don't think the characters are that well drawn. I don't think there's actually that much to the story. There's not a lot of, I guess, what you'd call mystery or excitement to it. And without spoiling anything, I didn't really feel like the ultimate outcome of the case, what actually happens with this amazing Klimt painting, didn't really touch my heart.
Movie number three, Effie Gray. All these movies about art.
Let me understand you. You are telling me that you still, to this day, do not understand the details of the most intimate relation within marriage. You have not experienced them.
He has never so much as touched me.
This is a crazy story. Emma Thompson wrote this.
Yes, and that's also her voice there. And this is based on the real story of Effie Gray, who was the young teen bride of the great art critic John Ruskin back in the 1800s. And for 5 years, she was married to this guy who was very oppressive, very cruel to her, never had sex with her. And she ended up falling in love with a painter of the time, John Everett Millais, and she wanted to marry him, and she was able to annul her first marriage because it had never been consummated. And so it's the story of this really bizarre love triangle. And while it's not a great movie, I wouldn't say that it was great. It's a little bit too slow. I don't think it's paced in the best way. It made me very interested in her whole story. And I ended up doing a lot of research on Effie Gray afterward. I was like, this is fascinating.
Podcast this week?
This week we're dealing with a listener who is asking for help to cry, and so we're prescribing some movies for her to help her to do that.
She wants to cry?
Yes, she does.
Oh, that's great. The therapist told her she can't cry.
A podcast public service. Thanks so much. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the podcast, along with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too, John.
You too. Support for The Takeaway comes from PBS and Masterpiece, presenting Wolf Hall, a tale of ruthless ambition and political intrigue set in the court of Henry VIII. Starring Mark Rylance and Damian Lewis, premiering Sunday at 10, 9 central on PBS.
This Sunday, the decades of the 50s and 60s wind down once again, courtesy of AMC, this time with the benefit of hindsight, and it's also the swan song of Matthew Weiner's creation, Mad Men, his reenactment of the most misunderstood decades of the 20th century.
Whatever your interpretation of the 50s is, you think it's Leave It to Beaver. People were laughing at Leave It to Beaver then. America's a subversive country. The number one bestseller is Catch-22. We are a self-questioning, self-critical culture.
Listen to him talk about books there. Matthew Weiner has spoken of his love, nostalgia, and found wisdom about the decades that said goodbye to one America and delivered hints of one to come.
The interesting thing is when you go into history, the way we do the show is we're trying to capture the impact on the average life of an average person. And, of course, the events of your life are more important. That's sort of one of the theses of the show is that, you know, whatever's going on in your life is still more important than history.
Matthew Weiner talking on The Takeaway in October of 2012. Books were a source for the themes of Mad Men, and they were literally props on the set. Don Draper pages through Portnoy's complaint. Roger Sterling reads David Ogilvy's Confessions of an Advertising Man. And Helen Peterson made the books of Mad Men the basis of a course she taught at Whitman College in the fall of 2013, Mad Men, Historiography, and Media. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So what an interesting idea for a course.
Yeah, it was really fun. I had a huge waiting list.
So the students were big fans of the show.
No. Most of them had never seen the show, which
is
fascinating.
So interesting.
There were two, I think, who had any exposure to the show. I mean, they knew of it. But part of it was, oh, this is a class where we get to just watch TV. That's always like the appeal of a media studies class.
It always works. Yes.
But on the other hand, like they knew this was going to be a very rigorous class.
What were the books in your syllabus?
There were so many books. And we didn't read, you know, a lot of them. We didn't read the entire thing. It was reading excerpts, but we read Sex and the Single Girl and parts of Confessions of an Advertising Man and Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, Revolutionary Road. The text that really would have formed the culture at the time. It doesn't matter if Don or Betty or Peggy would have actually been reading these books so much as they were influential on the cultural milieu.
What was pivoting? I mean, you talk about media and gender and even our sense of history itself, and that's right in the title of your course. What was pivoting?
Well, you know, even something like television, which we actually see the influence of television and how people are getting their news and what they do when they go home. You know, Don, who used to page through magazines to be inspired by advertisements, now, you know, creates and watches television advertisements. But also you're right at the pivot of what would become the women's rights movement and also the civil rights movement. And so that's part of, I'm sure, why Weiner chose this time, because we have a lot of crystallization of a country in transition.
And yet the women in Mad Men are so enslaved by these roles of subservience and really a kind of sexuality. That's what we do.
Absolutely. And I think that they negotiate their power within those roles. So you see someone like Joan. Joan is forced to offer herself as a sexual object, but that also gives her a partnership in the firm.
Do you think the history of this kind of negotiation and emergence using rules that are archaic and eventually going to be wiped out is more emblematic of the time than to, say, do the story of the feminist hero of the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of times people get frustrated that we're not following a hyper-feminist. We're not following, like, someone out in Berkeley who's part of the left. And those stories have been told. And I think it's much more interesting to see how the vast middle, the silent majority, is actually negotiating these issues.
Talk about Betty and Peggy as characters and how you were able to use those characters as a way of exploring books that then have other characters.
Right. I mean, Betty is essentially living out the feminine mystique. And in some ways, she's aware of it. You see, like, tinklings of awareness that happen in the first and second season. But then she really regresses. And I think she is a fantastic example of someone, like, a breathing, living embodiment of an ideology.
I think in many ways, the young girls of this generation get criticized for not being feminist enough because their sexuality is so sort of out front.
Mm-hmm.
How did your students grapple with that? And you as a teacher, how did you guide them?
Well, I think reading Sex and the Single Girl was very instructive because there's a lot about it that's outdated, that's homophobic and all sorts of things. But it also, the lessons about that Helen Gurley Brown gives still hold sway. And many of them said things like, you know, what is sexy isn't necessarily, you know, if you're the most beautiful girl in the room, that sort of thing. More, it's confidence, it's being powerful, it's living your own life. Like, those are things that really resonated with my students. But at the same time, I think that you're right. Even someone like Peggy, who actually, she tries to wield her sexuality, but she finds herself, because she's powerful in the office, she becomes asexual over and over and again and is really frustrated with her love life.
So she ends up being House of Cards in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Who do you identify with?
Peggy. I mean, Peggy's mm-hmm. the best. I love Betty, and I'm a huge Betty defender because I see her as railing against, in her very quiet and angry way, the expectations for a woman at that time. But I see Peggy as really my antecedent as a working woman who didn't find happiness in the traditional routes of marriage and children and instead found it through her work.
As a journalist now, mm-hmm. where do you think this goes in your life as a storyteller?
Yeah, no, I look at, you know, The Office has transformed so much in Mad Men from the beginning when it's all of these typewriters and it's clanging, there's secretaries all over. And then by the end, there's this massive computer in the middle of the office and it's like intimidating. And I think, you know, I look at the BuzzFeed startup office plan that's very, you know, there's like beautiful couches all around and that sort of thing. And I wonder what our office, what journalism will look like in 10 years.
And you could write the script for Buzz Babes.
No, I mean, we would never call ourselves babes, I don't think.
No, of course not. Yeah. But, you know, just trying to think of titles.
Oh, yeah, that like how fun. Other people would
yeah,
think about
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they would have never called themselves madmen.
Right.
Either, back
well,
then.
I think BuzzFeed, though, would be about the struggle of the white male to find.
Ah, Buzz Boys.
Yeah, well, because Mad Men is about the men in control and how women threaten that in some ways. And I think our current media moment is about the rise and the control of women and people of color, especially at BuzzFeed, and how white men are struggling against that.
All right, now you're threatening me. It's time to go. Anne Helen Peterson is former media studies professor who's taught a class on Mad Men at Whitman College. She's now a features writer at BuzzFeed. Good luck, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball.
Hey, take me out to the ball game.
Two strikes, ball one. Here comes the pitch. Strike three.
Here's something to take with you. One of the earliest baseball mascots was the Chicago Cubs stuffed bear cub. But the New York Mets created the first live-action mascot, the human in a suit, Mr. Met, in 1964. Next week, all the folksy, essential, musical backstage workers and baseball lovers who bring you the theater of America's national pastime.
The players didn't know, the umpires didn't know. It was a complete shock, but then the place went insane.
Trying to be professional about this, but my job is to be a professional goofball.
I want people to still remember that the sound of the organ is also the sound of baseball.
Send us your personal ballpark moments. Take us out to your memories. Photos welcome at our Facebook page or at Twitter at The Takeaway. We'll be posting some of the best to our website. Tune in all next week for ballpark figures right here on The Takeaway. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.